Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a fun book published by Roman and Littlefield in 2022, though also recently out on paperback, titled Red Sauce: How Italian Food Became American, which pretty much does exactly what it says. And you can see now why I'm so excited, because I would like to know where we get traditional Italian-American cuisine from, how, why this was developed over the late 19th and 20th centuries. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author of the book to the podcast, Ian McAllen. Thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to talk about red sauce with you.
I'm very glad to have you. Could you start us off with a bit of an introduction of yourself and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. You know, so I am half Italian American. My mother's side came to the United States in the early 20th century. And I grew up in northern New Jersey, which is a state with a huge population of Italian Americans. So this is something that has been culturally part of my life, my entire existence. And then my wife, same type of thing. Her family is half Italian American. Their side actually came a few years before mine. And yet they all grew up in the same kind of 20 miles outside of New York City. And so my wife and I were sitting down to dinner at an Italian American restaurant in New York City's West Village. It was a restaurant she had been going to since she was a baby. And they served a classic Italian-American red sauce menu. Things like lasagna and chicken parm and all of your favorite pastas with meatballs. And at the time, we were thinking about our own trips to Italy and, having a bit of red wine sold by the carafe in this restaurant. So the two of us had quite a bit to drink. And we got to thinking, why is this food that we're eating here, that has been so much a part of both of our entire lives, so different than the food we had in Italy or would be having in Italy on our next trip? And why is that different and how did that happen? So, you know, as these things go, I went home and I started doing some Googling, and I didn't have the answers I really wanted. And so I ended up at the New York Public Library, researching things that were a little bit more academic, a little bit more journalistic, you know, looking back at old newspapers. And I found myself taking notes. And then at a certain point, that research, you realize, is more than just a curiosity. It's more than just a dinner discussion. And all of a sudden, I was outlining a book that I wanted to write. And that's how we got to the first draft of Red Sauce.
I must admit, I'm not surprised that this started in a restaurant, given kind of the story that the book tells. And what a great way to start off. So thank you for that introduction. If we kind of go all the way back then to the beginning, in a lot of ways, of the story, the red of Red Sauce, perhaps obviously, comes from tomato sauce. But that's not an inevitable sort of, that's kind of what Italian food is. You know, there's a whole bunch of Italian food that doesn't have much to do with tomato sauce at all. So that seems like a reasonable place to start. Can you help us understand when and why tomato sauce did become popular in Naples and Italy? And why was it this bit of Italian food that made its way over to the US?
Sure. And so, you know, contextually, you know, obviously original tomatoes, along with a lot of other vegetables that are part of Italian cuisine, began as a New World crop. The Spanish exchanged them, the Colombian exchange. But how did they get, why Naples, why Sicily? These are territories that were at the time under Spanish rule over the centuries, leading up to the Great Migration, right? And so what was going on is the peasant class, the poorer people, had started eating tomatoes in the southern areas of Italy. I saw in numerous occasions in research comparisons to the Irish potato famine, where other crops had failed and tomatoes sort of became a default food in a lot of cases. And in places like Sicily and Naples, they could grow them often. So, you know, today we think of tomatoes as something that you can get all year long in the grocery store, in the supermarket. Sometimes they're grown around the world. Sometimes they're grown in the greenhouse. At the time, you needed that hot, dry climate in southern Italy to really grow them. But it was such a good climate for tomatoes. They could grow two or three full crops a year. And then they also were able to dry them often on the rooftops of their buildings. So this became a staple food, particularly through several famines that had afflicted the area. And so at the beginning of the Great Migration of Italians, the diaspora, which I will also add, does not just go to the United States. It starts earlier into Southern America and Central America. It goes around other parts of Europe as well. But around 1880 onward, Southern Italians are leaving what is now a newly united country, which is also its own kind of reason for tomatoes being a big part of this, is the economic divide between North and South in Italy was very big. Mainly, it was Southern Italians coming to the United States. They were bringing mainly the cuisines they were familiar with, which was tomatoes, and other vegetables, eggplants, peppers, things like artichokes. These are all things that had gotten integrated into Southern Italian cuisine and was coming with that group of immigrants. Now, in the north of Italy, a very different type of food. You had more animal fat. You had more rice. You had more cream and butter. And, you know, those foods don't really come until later, or not part of the Italian-American experience until later, in part, or in large part, because the vast majority of these people are coming from places like Sicily, Naples, anywhere south of Rome, in a region called the Mezzogiorno of Italy, which is, you know, the southern Italy. And so that cuisine is what arrives in the United States and what is really the basis for creating these dishes. A primarily vegetarian cuisine when they leave Italy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's how tomatoes become that basis.
So it's actually that last sentence I'd love to pick up on, because now that we understand the tomato side of this, let's talk about what's in the sauce. Because as you hinted at, when it leaves Italy, it's vegetables. But of course, if we think about a lot of these iconic dishes, we're talking meatballs, we're talking veal, we're talking a lot of like cream, butter, not exactly like low calorie vegetable based dishes. So how did that transition happen?
Well, so like I said, mostly what the Italian peasant class, the southern peasant class, is eating in Italy at the end of the 19th century are almost exclusively vegetables. When they have access to meat, it typically is one or two times a year on big high holidays like Easter, Christmas. And even then, even within that, many of these farmers would have only things like sausage, which is not a whole cut of meat. It can be filled with other things like fat and the cheaper cuts of meat. And so they come to the United States where food is inexpensive, and inexpensive not just in a global way, right? And I think it's worth noting that the United States, up until that period of time, had an enormous amount of resource wealth, right? Compared to the rest of the world, there are few people and lots of resources being produced. In Italy, not only were there many more people than resources available, but the tax system was one that wasn't beneficial for the individual. They got taxed even on the food that they grew in their gardens. The cost of living was very high. They had no, the people who were coming had no access to land. They were, a landless peasant group, right? And there wasn't enough land for them to buy. Whereas they come to the United States, they come into a city, they can grow food in their gardens. They don't have to pay tax on the vegetable plot and the windowsill of their tenement, right? And so all of a sudden they have more money to buy food as well, because the wages are better. They're doing labor work that, even though Italian immigrants typically were paid less than many other European immigrants, it was still more than they were able to earn in Italy, where there was a surplus of population. And so they turned that money, or that greater amount of resource, into cheaper foods, which meant they could suddenly buy meat. They could have access to higher quality, full cuts of meat. A lot of cases in Little Italy areas around the country, that is the neighborhoods where they settled, they often worked in meat packaging, and that allowed them access to reduced cost of meat cuts. So, if you're working at the meat factory and there's a mistake in the way a piece of meat is cut, they would often sell it to the workers at a discount. So suddenly they had access to the meat, but they don't have this history of cooking it. They don't know what to do with it. So a lot of these things evolved from essentially people who had never experienced hotel cooking, restaurant cooking, upper class cooking, how they imagined wealthy people would eat. And then also the conversion of vegetarian recipes. And I think one of the most clear examples of this would be a veal parmesan, which has a clear lineage to eggplant parmesan. They're essentially taking a vegetable dish and converting it into a meat dish. And then on top of that, there are a lot of reasons for Italian immigrants to have celebratory meals. So like I said, they would typically only have meat once or twice a year in Italy. Well, now they can have meat all the time. And then on top of that, there's lots of reasons where they have these celebrations on a regular basis, whether that's because a family member has arrived from Italy or they're suddenly able to make an investment that has paid off. And these are all things that are encouraging them to treat your typical Sunday afternoon like it's a big holiday, which then leads them to be more likely to cook that celebration meat dish several times a year rather than only once a year. And so that's essentially what we're looking at. We're looking at foods that were one time a holiday meal becoming a daily regular meal.
Mm. And of course, that idea of more access to meat as well. So that makes sense that they all come together in this way. Thinking then about kind of how any food moves from being part of one community to being a broader thing, we know that obviously the US's history with immigrants is quite contested really at any point in the time period. And obviously Italian-American food was part of that, kind of the immigrant, the other, the small enclave type thing. Of course, it doesn't stay that way, right? Everyone eats pasta now. So can you explain sort of how and why pasta became not just a food for this particular community, and why it was that this seems to have happened sort of between World War I and World War II?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the interesting facets of this is the way local governments in America treated Italian food. At first, they were like places like New York City were working very hard to change the mindset of immigrant children by prohibiting foods in schools like pasta. So the people, you know, children would go to school and they wouldn't be allowed to have their immigrant cuisine, their ethnic cuisine. And as you said, by the end of World War II, that had shifted, where the city and overall the government agencies were encouraging pasta. And the number one thing for that is macaroni, dried pasta, and fresh pasta are both things that are very economical for people to eat. They provide a lot of calories for very little money. And part of that, of course, is the United States is a breadbasket. You know, the Great Plains produce a lot of wheat, and that wheat can be turned into fresh pasta very easily. And so it became a very affordable thing to do. And the big economic issue between the wars, obviously, is the Great Depression, which influenced a lot of the shifts in the way people eat. And the 1930s is a period of time where you see a lot of Italian-influenced foods really becoming mainstream. And so the second reason for that is Italian restaurants, because they were seen as foreign and ethnic before World War II, is they were very bountiful portions. So people felt like they were getting a good deal. One of the examples that I look in the book is the idea of a prefix menu at Italian restaurants, and how the food that comes with that typically is more courses, bigger portions. And so what ends up happening is the Italian American restaurants have the association that if you're trying to be frugal, it's a great way to go have a big plate of pasta. And there, you know, within that, there are a few things. The early sort of idea of fast food were what were known as spaghetti houses. These were like almost cafeteria style restaurants, and they opened up not just in big cities on the East Coast, but across the country, really introducing Americans to the idea of pasta. And what it was is things like spaghetti with the choice of a dozen different sauces that you could to top the pasta with. And, you know, ranging from a basic tomato sauce to tomato sauce with mushrooms, or what I think is funny, it was a very popular dish, was a spaghetti alla Caruso at the time. And this is a tomato sauce made with chicken livers, which has since fallen out of favor, in part because people rarely eat chicken livers in the same volume that they used to 100 years ago. But all of that really helped spread Italian-American food on at least the initial level as a cost-conscious way of filling up your belly. And so that's really like the impetus for that. And of course, after World War II, a lot of servicemen have spent time both in Europe eating Italian food, so in Italy, and also some of the rations that they ate were mass-produced Chef Boyardee canned spaghetti and SpaghettiOs, the raviolis that they would make, and the other canned pasta from manufacturers like Chef Boyardee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that those things all make sense coming together. And it's entertaining in a way almost to think of spaghetti houses like today's Chipotle or something like that.
No, absolutely. And like you could walk in and very cheaply have it in a huge bowl of pasta.
Right. Yeah, which would be enticing. So if we think kind of the next step further is beyond the spaghetti house, beyond the canned stuff, there is, of course, also the spread of the iconic sort of Italian-American restaurant, you know, with the red checkered tablecloths and the carafes of red wine. You know, it's a very clear visual iconography as well as a particular menu. How and when did that concept expand beyond the initial enclave in New York?
So what is really amazing about that whole, the whole visual that is created is even at the time, the restaurateurs that are opening up Italian restaurants are trying to capture a kind of nostalgia that they, that never really existed even in Italy. Right. And they're creating in the same way today, chain restaurants cover their walls with, you know, fake, you know, sort of prop pieces to have that nostalgia. That's essentially what was happening. You know, the red checkered tablecloth gingham print was very common, and actually, you know, other restaurants or other ethnic restaurants at the time also had those kinds of things. So in New York in the early 20th century, German restaurants were very popular. Blue gingham or green gingham was very popular in those restaurants. Italians embracing the red, you know, was just a way of differentiating them while also, you know, reflecting back this idea that, oh, we're just like these other places. That style was so popular, even non-Italian restaurants in some cases ended up replicating that look and feel just because they liked it. Kind of like a Disney World-esque interpretation of, you know, if you go to Epcot Center and you go to the World Showcase of Disney's interpretation of all the countries around the world, that's essentially what people were doing with Italian-American restaurant look and feel. And so that today, you know, we think of in a modern iteration of that, the Olive Garden chain, which I believe is globally available, has that Tuscan look, right? And that's just simply a new version of the red checkered tablecloth from 100 years ago. It's someone's fantasy idea of what a themed restaurant should be. And, you know, certainly Italian-American restaurants were serving Chianti bottle or Chianti wine. And the idea of packaging it in those round bottles with the wicker around it was someone's idea of what it should look like, right? And it was simply became the expectation that a patron had, and that's how it evolved into sort of more of a universal truth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I like the idea of the Disneyfication of it. Yeah, I think it captures it quite well.
I would also say, like, there's certainly in the post-war period you were starting to see Italian American restaurants that were doing imitating French restaurants with white table service, white linen, and that was really representative of as Italian American restaurants were becoming more upscale, where they're shifting from economy, low cost, high volume into sort of a fancier experience. You do see that shift, and I think that is a really also an interesting reflection of how customers, on one level, want that themed restaurant, but as you move to a more upscale clientele, the expectation is to at that time to look more French.
Mm-hmm. So let's, if we continue the trajectory, right, we've gone from Naples to a particular small immigrant community to being more aware of the food to now the restaurants expanding. But the last stage is kind of, at least in my mind, I think of it as going from there's this thing called Italian food or Italian American food, and maybe sometime, you know, on a Friday night, that's where we'll go out for dinner, on a Sunday afternoon, whatever, to thinking of something like spaghetti and meatballs as like, oh yeah, I guess it's Italian, but everyone has it all the time. It's kind of for everyone. It's not necessarily ethnic or a special occasion food. It's just sort of American in a way. How do we get to that stage?
Well, so in the, so, you know, post-war period where like by the 1950s, 1960s, right, we're moving towards an era of convenience food in America, right? The big push is for housewives to open up a can or open up a frozen food and be able to eat, you know, eat dinner without having spent all day preparing it. And that really was an interesting space for Italian American food, because one of the big pushes there, it comes from Stouffer's, the manufacturers of frozen meals. They launch a frozen food line of these casserole type dishes, one of which was a lasagna, an interpretation of an Italian bolognese lasagna. You know, the elements of both the southern and northern lasagna are in it, but it is one of the few dishes in the Stouffer's line that is successful, that you know, people were buying, and as a result, that meant frozen lasagna as a category in your grocery took off from that moment on. In the 60s, you start getting your jarred tomato sauces as well, ragu, and eventually, a little bit later than that, Prego. And these become national brands with, you know, a national holding company behind them. And the, you know, that's another example of, like, buy a jar of sauce, and 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, you've boiled pasta and you have a meal. And so, you know, from that perspective, Italian American food was really on the lower end, on the low price point end, became super easy for all Americans to participate in. Now, a lot of, you know, this is also at the time when pizzerias were beginning to grow. And I think it's easy to overlook the impact of the pizzeria in also penetrating into the United States, into that culture, bringing with it pasta dishes, bringing with it chicken parm, veal parmesan heroes. And one of the things that happened in the 1950s was pizza went from being this niche food only available in a handful of enclaves in Italian neighborhoods in urban areas to very widespread. And a lot of that had to do with the development of a gas-fired pizza oven by created by this guy, Ira Nevin, who is a aerospace engineer, but he came from a family of bricklayers. And so he had experience building ovens. He was an engineer. He served in the army, ate pizza in Italy, came back and created the Baker's Pride oven, which really paved the way for anyone to open a corner pizzeria. And once you have that coming around, then people are again, convenience food, pizza in the United States, you get a box to go. Pizza delivery comes out a few years later. And that in the 1960s is really when you see a lot of these pizzerias opening as far into the Midwest and into California even. And that's another avenue for which Italian American food is really like spreading really rapidly, and then turning into large corporations. So like Pizza Hut, Domino's, you know, a little bit later into the 1980s, you have things like Olive Garden and Macaroni Grill, which are larger chains that are more than just pizza. But that's really where you're coming from is from that ground up.
Mm-hmm. No, that's helpful to understand. As we've gotten to kind of the peak of spread of red sauce, we do have to talk a little bit about, it doesn't quite stay there. So one angle into this is in the book, you talk about kind of the iconic restaurant Di Paolo's in New York, and how if we look at it kind of over the generations, in a lot of ways, it exemplifies the evolution of Italian American food over especially the 20th century. So can you take us through kind of this restaurant and those stages?
Yeah. So, you know, essentially what happened in urban areas like New York City, Boston, Baltimore, Philadelphia, smaller cities like Newark, New Jersey, and then as far west as Chicago, St. Louis, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, you have the immigrant community settles in a spot and it creates a little what is termed a Little Italy neighborhood. And for the first generation, all the businesses there are catering to the Italian immigrants. Most of them are speaking, at first, a lot of them are speaking the dialect of the community that they originated from. Because keep in mind, in 1880, most of the peasant class are not speaking Italian, they're speaking dialect. The idea of national Italian doesn't really come around until Mussolini and the post-war period, where everyone's really taught a nationalized Italian language. So everyone's speaking their local dialect, which is also where you get dialect words like you hear in TV shows like The Sopranos, like gabagool or ricotta, right? These are words that were the dialect of from southern Italy and not Italian, right? And so at first generation of businesses, the Italians are living there, they're going to their businesses. The next generation begins to leave those enclaves. They're spreading out into the suburbs. They're becoming wealthier. And for the first 50 years, you're getting a continuous flow of immigrants to replace them. So Little Italy businesses are doing great. They're thriving. More people are coming. But as the immigrant group matures from being first generation to second generation, and now into third generation, people are moving farther and farther away from these core neighborhoods. They're spending less time and money. They're integrating. They're speaking English. Their children are speaking English. Their grandchildren are speaking English. They're becoming professional class members who are not operating local shops anymore. They're not shopkeepers. They're lawyers and doctors, and they're moving to the suburbs. So now, what happens? By the 2000s, by the 1990s, 1980s, the Little Italy core is really serving groups of people who are either coming to visit grandparents or, an older generation that's dying. Or by now, the 2020s, you're talking about largely people who are two or three generations away from having lived in those neighborhoods. They're only coming as tourists. They're coming to eat the food, buy some trinkets, go to a festival, but the experience is really, really limited. So now if you want to talk about a specific place like DiPaolo's, which is an importer of Italian meats and cheeses. But originally that was a family business from more than a century ago. I believe they started out simply doing cheese, making cheese, then eventually importing cheese. Then they expand to import Italian products generally. And now they're still in Little Italy, but Little Italy is shrinking. And they're still probably the best place to go in the neighborhood for imported meats and cheeses and imported foods. They have now a restaurant attached to them. So originally it was just a store. But back in 2019, they opened up a little wine bar with food and drink. And so what they're really doing is they're following this evolution, right? So at first, they're serving the immigrant community that is there. They're providing people who don't leave that neighborhood with the meats and cheeses that they need. Then they're evolving to become a specialty store. In the middle of the 20th century, even as late as the late 1980s, you couldn't get specialty cheeses from Italy in your regular supermarket in the United States. That's really something that has evolved, and we've come to believe that you can walk into any upscale grocery store in America and get Parmesan, you can get mozzarella, you can get, even beyond those, the four or five basic Italian cheese, you get into real specialty stuff. Very hard to do up until even a few years ago outside of, core urban areas. So they're providing that service. And now they're moving again, shifting businesses again to serve food in a more like come for the afternoon and eat and we'll serve you type of way. And I think that's a natural evolution that's happening in all of the Little Italies. Certainly places like Boston has a beautiful Little Italy. It's a tiny couple blocks, and they still have things like Bova's Bakery, which is a 24-hour Italian bakery, and a bunch of other little shops and restaurants. But the main economic driver for them are people coming as visitors, either day trip tourists or longer, visiting the city of Boston, and they make a stop in that neighborhood. And so that is the evolution that's really happening in these ethnic enclaves around the country.
And so many pieces are causing that, as you detailed for us, in terms of changing economics, generational change. One of them also that you talk about in the book is differences in where Italian immigrants are coming from. They're no longer coming from Naples with this tomato-based culture. You talk about in the second half of the 20th century, you get different Italian immigrants. So can we add that into the picture of how this impacts red sauce culture?
So in essence, immigration begins to slow leading up to World War II. This is a result of changes in the United States and also Italian fascism was trying to restrict the outflow of human labor as capital, essentially. So that if men and laborers are leaving Italy, that's bad for the fascist state. But then, World War II happens and Europe is torn asunder. But more importantly, the South has had 50, 75 years of population leaving. And then on top of that, now the northern industrial areas, the places in Italy that were the economic engine of the country, have also been flattened by World War II. So all those people now are looking for jobs. And so what ends up happening is it flips. You have many fewer people coming from southern Italy where because it was more agrarian in nature, it was less likely to be damaged in the war. And then also you needed all of that agriculture as the economy restarted post-war. But the North, where there were jobs that were dependent on factories, a lot of those people came to the United States. And so the culture that I previously talked about, where you had Northern culture versus Southern culture, all of a sudden you were having more Northerners come. And let's the other thing is, Fewer immigrants overall were coming. Beginning in 1880, you had 4 million people coming from Italy, and that number was much smaller by the post-war period. And so those are impacting the way the way restaurants are being staffed, for instance, right? So you have these Northern Italians coming to work and they end up working in local businesses in Little Italy because the networks are there. But the things like they become a cook in a kitchen, they're learning about Italian American cuisine because they didn't cook any of that food in Northern Italy, and certainly not the adaptations that 50 or 60 or 70 years of being in America has created. And so what's really fascinating today, in 2020, where you still have Italians that come to places like, often they start out in places like Little Italy, or Little Italy is around the country, they're totally unfamiliar with veal parmesan. But then they become the cook in the kitchen to cook it, or they become the server at the restaurant to serve it. And so this is an interesting evolution where we're basically teaching immigrants from Italy about Italian American cuisine that they're not familiar with.
No, definitely a change. Obviously, pinpointing an exact start or an exact end of anything is tricky, but you do at least posit the idea in the book that pasta primavera might be the end of the red sauce era. Why?
So, I also try to, I think the golden age of Italian American cuisine really was the pre-war years and the years right after World War II, where you both have innovation still happening, but more respect for Italian American cuisine. And by the 1970s, essentially you get people moving away from that kind of cuisine and that style of cooking. And there are a bunch of factors that are contributing. There's a greater interest in the Mediterranean diet as a concept, right? And you might think, oh, Italian American food clearly would fall within that realm, but for all the cultural reasons we just talked about, Italian American food typically was meat heavy, it was cheese heavy, it really wasn't as Mediterranean as it needed to be as part of the seven country study to be fish heavy and olive heavy and vegetarian friendly, right? So that was one thing. You also had, like I said, the shift in Northern Italians are starting to come. So now these are people who are starting to open up restaurants that are reflective of more Northern cuisine, things like risotto, pesto. I mean, the introduction of pesto, we think of as this iconic Italian food, but it was very rare in the United States through the 1960s and through the 1970s to have pesto. So all of these things are starting to happen. And then you have this French restaurant that the, you know, on Long Island, the chef and the owner concoct pasta primavera, which is a very complicated pasta dish. The list of ingredients, the original recipe in the book I saw was 2 pages long of ingredients, right? And it's fresh vegetables. It's, you know, the big thing was fresh peas that are, you know, difficult to harvest and get those fresh peas rather than like a bag of frozen peas or canned peas, right? And so they create this dish and it's an instant hit. But it's such a hit that within a few years, you can get pasta primavera, first of all, anywhere in New York City, certainly the tri-state area. And by the mid-80s, you're talking about the assumption that pasta primavera is this traditional Italian cuisine that is part of that culture, when it was really created in the New York City area for a French restaurant at a time when people were moving away from Italian-American food or traditional red sauce Italian-American food. And so to me, that was really like, well, if you're replacing menu items in your traditional Italian-American restaurant with this French-inspired, not red, you know, fresh vegetable heavy dish, it's probably a sign that's the end of the red sauce cuisine.
Yeah, it is pretty much the exact opposite of everything you've told us about so far. So there we go. I have a penultimate question that I ask a number of authors, but especially those that kind of, I know, have spent a bunch of time digging through interesting archives, because that's always such fun as a historian to get to do. So I was wondering if there's anything you came across in the research or writing of this book, whether or not it actually made it into the book itself, that surprised you that you could maybe tell us about?
Yeah, so the first, there are a couple of things that I think are kind of related here, which is one, how sometimes these foods were reinterpreted back by British and continental Europeans, right? Either because they first appear in the United States and then go back to Europe, or how there are divergent foods that have the same name that are not Italian, like lasagna bolognese, a British lasagna bolognese, which is clearly inspired by Italian immigrants making their way there, fundamentally different than the way you would experience that in the United States. And to see things like puttanesca, which, you know, I think I actually was reading comments about puttanesca sauce in British English language newspapers several years before they get to the United States. And to see that there is this sort of divergence on the continent and in Britain from the American experience of an interpretation of Italian food, and to think about how, particularly under the European Union, how Italian food in Europe typically is better and closer related to Italian food in Italy, without the sort of with clearly interpretations inspired by the surrounding countryside that they're in, but totally different and disconnected from Italian American experience, and then. The sort of follow-up to that, or the other element of that, is seeing how these elements have localized in some places. So with red sauce, I'm really talking about things, you know, you can get spaghetti and meatballs and could have gotten spaghetti and meatballs in any Italian-American restaurant in the United States and any place around the world that's identifying as Italian-American. But then to come across where local communities didn't have certain foods, or they created a food that never went national, And so, you know, one of the great examples that I briefly mentioned in Red Sauce, which has in the writing of Red Sauce has become more relevant because of television, is the Italian beef. So I think I have two sentences to the Italian beef in Red Sauce, mostly saying, oh, this is a sandwich you can get in Chicago. You know, since then in the United States, we've had the television show The Bear come out. And The Bear is a the first season of the show is all based around this chef coming home to his Chicago Italian beef restaurant, serving Italian beef sandwiches and trying to turn that into a fancier upscale restaurant and the struggles with that. So now there's this national audience who's like, what is the Italian beef? And so I think it was really fascinating to see that there are these super local foods that never made it into any kind of national cuisine, or in the case of the Italian beef in Chicago, like they have a moment because they're on TV. And you know, and then that plays out similarly. I'm a Tricciana sauce, and I think I mentioned this in the book, is there's a moment where there's a AP article or the equivalent wire service article about an elephant in Rome who dies from eating spaghetti amatriciana. Now, before that article, there's very few references to amatriciana sauce in the United States or generally. After that, pretty rapidly it becomes widely available. So it was one of those moments where a national news item is impacting the sort of zeitgeist of how people view food. And I'm not saying people went to the restaurant and said, you know, I read about the elephant dying from.
Give me the food that killed the elephant.
it does indicate how these things spread. And you know, a lot of these different sauces have that moment.
That's fun. Thank you for sharing those with us. Especially the ones that, you know, only got a little mention in the book. We get a bit more now. I only have one final question, which is, this book obviously is out. It's even out now in paperback if people want to get their hands on it. Is there anything you might be working on now or look to be working on in the future, whether or not it's on this topic, whether or not it's a book that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah. So like I said, there are all of these really fascinating hyper-local foods. And, you know, the Chicago beef is just one of many. And I'm starting to do research into these very regional Italian American foods. And, you know, things like, you know, having been from New Jersey, I was even, you know, surprised to learn this myself, is New Jersey had developed what is called an Italian hot dog. And, you know, the hot dog obviously is a very American type of food to begin with. And, you know, it's only about 110, 120 years old itself, the creation of the actual hot dog. And so I started reading about in Newark, New Jersey, which is just outside of New York City. It had an old Italian American neighborhood. And in the 1930s, Newark developed four or five restaurants that sold what is called an Italian hot dog. Now, this is a special Sicilian bun. So it's like a, you know, not a traditional hot dog bun. It's more of a circular bun. I think traditionally they put two hot dogs in it. They topped it with onions and peppers, like a sausage and pepper sandwich, and fried potatoes. And so I was looking into this. This is not something you can get anywhere outside of, you know, 50 miles outside of Newark, New Jersey. You're never even going to see this thing. Even within that, like I said, this is a Great Depression food. You know, hot dogs were cheap, you know, sausage peppers were cheap, or peppers were cheap, and potatoes were cheap. This is, you know, by the mid-1950s, there were two dozen places in New Jersey selling this Italian hot dog. And then I started to try to find it. And some of those places have closed. In the last couple of years, four or five places that were famous for them, they closed, but because either the owner retired or had died. So it was really this generational thing that was starting to disappear. I even went to a place on the boardwalk, the Jersey Shore, who promised on their menu, they had, you know, the Italian hot dog, and the woman behind the counter, oh, we don't have that today. We don't have the bread. And so there are the elements to it that are disappearing, right? Like if you can't get the special bread, and even if you have the hot dog and the peppers and the potatoes, that, you know, you sort of don't have that thing anymore. So that got me going down the rabbit hole of you know, learning more about the New Jersey Italian hot dog, but also all of the other regional foods, that like the Italian beef. There's a Philadelphia pork sandwich, which has a similarly interesting story. And so all over the country, anywhere you have an Italian enclave, more or less, there's some unique food that never makes it to national attention that is not spaghetti and meatballs. It's the, you know, Italian hot dog of that area. And so I'm really fascinated by that. I'm trying to track down those histories and find those out. Like I said, before people die, before they retire.
Yeah. No, exactly.
So.
Well, that sounds quite fun. Best of luck with those investigations.
Yeah, thank you.
And while you are traversing the country eating unlikely sandwiches, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Red Sauce, How Italian Food Became American, published by Roman and Littlefield in 2022. Ian, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I loved this conversation. It was great.